Our guest is Ed Hawker, who is from the Pacific Palisades, California, by way of NBC and World War II. And how are you doing today?
Yeah, very well, thank you, Chuck.
Good.
How are you doing?
We're doing great, and we're glad to talk with you.
Very good.
When did you first join NBC?
Well, in 1935, actually. I'd been going to college in Pennsylvania, and it was Depression time. Mm-hmm. I had to go back to New York, which is my home, and take advantage of my grandmother, who had a house there. So I was enrolled at NYU, New York University,
uh-huh.
and had to get a job. I took a course in speech at NYU, and the talking to the professor the second day, a woman, she said, "You need a job?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Take this note up to NBC in Rockefeller Center." And there I was.
Just like that.
Just like that. So after I got out of college, NBC said, "Do you want to stay on?" And I said, "Yes." And where? And I said, "The news department."
Mm-hmm.
Of course, being a guy in the page up there, I knew more of the executives in NBC than most of the executives themselves, wandering around NBC. Mm-hmm. So I went up to the news department. They said, "Yes, you can have a job if you can type." That was a Thursday.
Uh-huh.
I said, "Yeah, I can type." They said, "Oh, when do you want to start?" I said, "Tuesday." It's the next Tuesday. So I went down to the Underwood Elliott Fisher Typewriter Company in the basement of the Rockefeller Center building, got a book on how to type, and spent hours, ASDF, you know, SAD, ASDF, pages of that
uh-huh.
stuff. And by Tuesday, I could touch type.
Wow.
The boss said, "Ed, I have an apology to make to you." And I said, "What's that, Milt?" He said, "When you told me you could type last Thursday, I didn't believe you." And I just laughed. I said, "Milt, I owe you an apology. When I said I could last Thursday, I couldn't." and told him what had happened. Well, he started laughing. We became very good friends.
Well, that's wonderful. You see, you got to believe in yourself that you could do that over the weekend.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
Absolutely. Now, how did you move from NBC in New York to the NBC's coverage in D-Day? What happened along the line to get you to find yourself in France?
What happened was I progressed at NBC, you know,
uh-huh.
from a copy boy on up, I was finally doing the morning news roundup for them, and the boss asked me to stay up until 9 one morning, he said, "King George VI is coming over from England to spend 6 weeks in Canada and the United States. Would you like to travel with him?" I said, "Well, you don't say no to something like
that.
Yeah. So I did, and to make it brief, I did. And then I was now moving on to being an on-the-air type, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved me down to Washington from New York. And for a year or so, I covered Franklin Roosevelt and on his Tuesday news conferences, and then NBC refused to send me back to New York, so I quit and went with the Associated Press, and almost a day to the year, walked across the street from AP to NBC. They're both in Rockefeller Center,
uh-huh.
and as I walked into the NBC newsroom, they said, "Ed, you're rehired." So I was back, and from there it was on to London
mm-hmm.
as a war correspondent.
For NBC now.
For NBC,
yes,
uh-huh. Yeah, they sent me over. I was a little bit annoyed with them. I said, "What about expenses over there? It's expensive living in London." They said, "Oh, we pay 50%. And I got over there. I was so angry at them, I almost said, you know, I'm not going. I got over there, and the secretary at NBC in London, as I came in, said, the boss sent you a cable. It was dated the day I left New York on the convoy, and said, you have your salaries doubled, and you're on a 100% expense account."
Mm.
So I forgave him.
What was the reason? Why did they do that?
Oh, he was just being mean. He was
Oh, he was giving you the business beforehand.
He was giving the business beforehand, yeah.
I see. Well, now, when was that? What time?
Now, well, that was in end of 42. So uh-huh. The end of 42.
Okay, so you were right in the midst of it.
Early 43, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we were there. There were air raids on London mm-hmm. quite frequently.
Were you in danger?
Oh, well, everyone was uh-huh. to an extent. Uh-huh. But, you know, and being in a big city like that, you don't figure that an enemy bomb has your name on it, really. My wife went over the same way. She was called, you remember, Wild Bill Donovan, mm-hmm. OSS?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She'd gone to school in Boston and traveling around with a young lawyer from Harvard Law School who went with Donovan, and he called her in New York one day and said, you want to come down and take a job as secretary to Donovan? She said, no, I don't want to live in Washington, but if you send me to London, I'll go. He said, you mean you go to London with all that bombing going on? She said, yes, I'd like to see London. So she arrived in London, too.
Now, this was before you were married.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And that's where you met then, over there.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, now, where were you on, well, let's say, the eve of D-Day?
Well, what happened was NBC had sent me to a B-26 base south of London to do it on an assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finished the assignment, I went in to thank the base commander, he said, oh, you hadn't heard. And I said, heard what? He said, you're spending the night here. And I said, thanks for the invitation, Colonel, but I said, I've got to get back to London. He said, Ed, it's not an invitation, it's an order, security. You're staying here for the night. You'll discover why tomorrow morning. So they woke me up at 4 o'clock and said, this is D-Day. That's the first I mm-hmm. really heard, although I did suspect, you know.
Well, there was everybody was on edge about all of this stuff, right?
Yeah. NBC Chuck never said point blank, you mind going off, getting your head shot off, or, you know, to the correspondents. How they said, now, on D-Day, we're going to have these assignments. Someone will have to go over in a bomber. Medium bomber, a big bomber, high-flying bomber. Someone else will have to go over in a battleship, someone else in a troop ship, you know, et cetera, uh-huh. et cetera. And do you have any of you have any objections? Actually, all the reporters, NBC reporters in London, except one, said no. They had no objections to any of them.
They wanted to be in the midst of all the action.
Well, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And the one who said he couldn't take that. They sent him to Sweden where there was no war going mm-hmm. on, of course. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so, but the it was disquieting being told at a B-26 base that I was it. Rather unsettling, really. A B-26 had really an erratic reputation. It was called variously the flying coffin, the flying prostitute, things like that.
Mm.
And it wasn't my idea of how I should make my first trip to France, if you see what I mean.
Well, you you were with a bombing raid then, weren't you?
Yeah, so we took off. Yeah, what they did was they gave me a flak suit to put on and a flak suit to sit on and a parachute. And the colonel had the center door panel taken out so I could see out. Actually, you couldn't see a lot because the weather wasn't that good. But at any rate, we took off, and you know how many sorties there were over Normandy that day, Chuck?
No, how many?
14,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, you can imagine what would happen at O'Hare, for instance, if this were going to happen in one day. Well, we took off, and we couldn't just fly across the channel. It wasn't very far, as you know. Mm-hmm. The channel at that point is only about 20 miles across from England. We had to go into a holding pattern and follow the plan, and couldn't really set out for for the bombing raid over Normandy, and had what turned out to be a successful hit on a German base.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't just set out until we had the word from Supreme Headquarters, you know. So we finally got the word and set out, I'd been given a headset in my position in the center of the plane. I could hear the engineer talking to the pilot and to the rest in this V formation that we were in, and he had a stopwatch. He'd count out 50 seconds and start all over again, counting out 50 seconds. The reason was that they'd figured out that it took the German anti-aircraft types 55 seconds to get a bead on you, and if they kept diverting, they would, of course, miss the flak.
Uh-huh.
And I actually saved us, I'm convinced.
They knew what they were doing, didn't they?
They knew what they were doing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, how long was that flight that you
were
on?
Well, altogether, it ran about, from the time we left that base in England till we returned, it was about 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
And we saw a lot of the nearly, 4,000 ships below us. As someone noted, that it was sort of like wall-to-wall ships.
I mean, it must have been an absolutely spectacular sight with all those planes in the air and all those ships
in
the sea.
Yeah, and the weather wasn't that good that, mm-hmm. that you could see all of it, really. The initial D-Day was for the 5th of June,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the weather was so bad that... the weather forecaster, by the way, this may be interesting to you, the weather forecaster, Dr. Irving Crick, is a retired meteorologist from Caltech. He's about 88, 89, 90 now. He lives in Pasadena, which is where Caltech is. And he changed it from 5th to 6th. And the rest of the Air Force's the rest of the meteorologists around the mm-hmm. United States Weather Bureau, the Royal Air Force Weather Bureau, British Air, the British Weather Bureau all said they couldn't do it on the 6th. And Irving told Eisenhower that, yes, he thought he could. And
Ike said, we've got to go. We've got all these people ready that we
can't
stop it anymore,
well,
I guess.
Irving said to him, yeah, there's one other outfit that says you can't do it on the 6th. And Eisenhower said, what? He said, yeah, the German Weather Bureau. They figure things out the same way the United States Weather Bureau figures them out. And they will say it can't be done on the 6th, too, so they won't be prepared. I said, good idea, so away they went.
Oh, well. The drama of it, it's amazing.
Yeah, it really was, the whole thing.
Now, when you came back
to
home base there, what was your next, as an NBC correspondent, what was your next move? What did you do?
Well, all the rest of the NBC types were across the channel up to their knees in mud.
Mm-hmm.
I was back in London in my comfortable London flat. And the only one around, as a matter of fact, I broadcast for about 48 hours without getting any sleep.
Oh.
Incidentally, with David Sarnoff, he was the head of RCA, as you know, and my top boss, sitting across the table from me. He was a colonel in the Army mm-hmm. and head of communications for Eisenhower. But the next move was I really wanted to get into the war. I wanted to cover one of the armies, and they finally sent me over to cover George Patton.
Oh.
That was one of my more unpleasant assignments with NBC.
Uh-huh. That was a little later on, then. That was
It was before the war ended, of course.
Yeah,
but
right.
I distinctly did not like Patton. I thought he was arrogant. But the final straw came was when NBC said, "Describe Patton's press camp in a few words." I sent wrote out a note to cable to them. Patton press camp more like rest camp. And the censor came up to me and said, you know, Ed, the old man got to see everything that's written about him. I said, well, show him this kind of thing. And he said, you really want to send? I said, sure, there's nothing sensual about it anyway. And the reason was, Chuck, Patton's, unlike most of the generals, Patton's press camp was at Army Rear.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were at Army Forward. So every day, the reporters from Patton's press camp had to go 25, 30, 35 miles up these war-beaten roads to the front and then back over the same bumpy roads. And it was a pain in the neck, you know.
So you weren't happy with Patton?
No, so they finally, I finally moved to an army, the 6th mm-hmm. Army Group, from the 3rd Army down to the 6th Army Group. And Patton, incidentally, didn't like me either, so we sort of agreed on...
Well, how much personal contact did you have with General Patton?
Well, every morning we'd see him in the war room. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you yourself. You
well, right, as there are maybe 5, 6, 7 correspondents, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
in the war room every day, and then you'd go in, and there you'd see him every morning for an hour and a half, and you got to be know a man fairly well, you know,
mm-hmm.
seeing
mm-hmm.
him that often. Sure. Years later, NBC called me home for a brief period, and I finally got on a plane out of what it now today is JFK. It wasn't then, it was before Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, I was going back to Germany by way of London and Frankfurt, arriving in Frankfurt, and we took off and I went to sleep and then woke up and I said, my Lord, we're coming down. I've flown, here we are arriving in London, our first stop, and I've slept all the way. But he said, we're putting down in Boston. You know, that was like a few minutes from New York. They opened the door of the plane, put out a small ladder, and the woman got in, and the only empty seat in the plane was one next to me. I said, would you like to sit next to the window? She sat down. We took off again. She turned to me and said, I'm Mrs. George Patton.
Oh, boy.
And I mentioned I had known her husband and how sorry. Oh, he's been killed, you know.
Uh-huh.
He's killed in that accident
yes.
near Heidelberg. And she was on her way to Frankfurt and then to Luxembourg where he was buried to see where he was buried.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She was one of the more delightful women I have ever met,
mm-hmm.
Mrs. Patton. All the way over to Frankfurt, I was wondering how in the world she got tied in with that guy, George.
A little profile of a general.
Yeah, a little profile of a
Ed
general.
Ed Hawker, I just want to get back a little bit to D-Day for a minute yet. And when you got off that plane after that bombing raid.
Yeah.
And where did you go? Did you go to the BBC studios or whether
no? We
NBC?
Had all of the broadcasters were at the British Ministry of Information, a subterranean. Really, was way
mm-hmm.
down because
mm-hmm.
of the German bombs that were hitting around us all the time. V1s, V2s, you know.
Yeah.
We were way underground in studios and workrooms, and we and the censors were down there with us. We knew them all, and I'd type something out from a communique, for instance, and mostly in the beginning, Chuck, the information we were putting out was all based on communiques. In other
mm-hmm.
words, completely controlled by the military, what
mm-hmm.
we were saying,
mm-hmm.
and the censors worked on that. We couldn't say much beyond what the communiques were saying.
You were broadcasting live, actually. I mean,
yeah,
you were at an open mic and you were broadcasting. Prior to the broadcast, did you prior to the live broadcast, did you file a cable or a report to NBC in the United States?
No, we were given a pretty free hand, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We did our own writing.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the censor, handed our copy to the censor, and then went on the air. Oh yes, what I was going to say in reply to your question a few moments ago. NBC was completely live up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I had gone to that B-26 base the day before was that for the first time, NBC was going to use a recorder, and I was going to use that on the 5th of June for the first time.
Oh, I see.
It was a wire mm-hmm. recorder. Mm-hmm. Are you old enough to know?
Yeah, sure.
Remember the mm-hmm. wire recorder?
Right.
Well, it was a wire recorder.
Very heavy.
Very heavy.
Right.
And you know what? I left after the trip across the channel and back. I drove back to London. I left the wire recorder at that B-26 base, and I never did go back to get it.
It may still be there as a monument.
It may still be there as a monument. Yeah.
Well, you're still here, and we're glad that you've got some memories of this very special time.
I was thinking of that. Mm-hmm. There's Red Muller, Merrill Muller. There's W.W. Chaplin, Bill Chaplin. There was Elmer Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, there were a few others of us at NBC. I think I'm the last of the NBC D-Day reporters alive.
You will probably never forget that experience, will you?
Well, you can't.
Yeah,
you can't. Had you ever thought, you know, that was the beginning of the end for Hitler? The mm-hmm. German generals mm-hmm. knew it. He didn't, or at least he wouldn't admit it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it hadn't been, and if Germany had won, we'd all be speaking Germany today. We're speaking German today.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Ed, appreciate very much your spending some time with us to talk about one of the most famous days in the history of the world, I think.
History of military warfare and the world, too, mm-hmm. yes.
And you're in retirement now? You're doing okay? You're doing well?
Yeah, I've been retired since I'm 83,
mm-hmm.
as I may have mentioned, and I've been retired since I was 65. That's, 15, 18 years or something.
Do you ever watch CNN or NBC TV news or listen to it here or there and say, geez, you know, I wish I could get back in the swim of this.
Yeah, I had a letter from Tommy Brokaw the other day.
Tommy Brokaw?
Brokaw. Yeah, he and I worked together.
Uh-huh.
He was out here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of our main anchormen out here after Chet Huntley left.
Well, you did a good job with all of that stuff over the years, and I appreciate very much your talking with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Chuck, and I don't know, maybe I'll fly over to Normandy next for the.
You think you might go back in June?
I may go back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it might
just
be
a. Tommy suggested he'd be there, and. Tom Brokaw,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
And be interesting.
Well, we'll maybe we'll see you.
Yeah.
On the television. Huh?
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.